320-0445, consolidated with 320-0446, the people of the state of Illinois, Appalee versus Zevian R. Marks, appellant.
Ms. Assefa, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Lidette Assefa, and I represent the appellant Zevian Marks, along with my co-counsel, 7-Eleven law student, Andrew Hartford. We are here on behalf of Zevian Marks, a teenager who is serving 45 years in prison for a crime that occurred when he was 14 years old. We ask that this court vacate Zevian's convictions and remand for a new trial, or alternatively, vacate his sentence and remand for a new sentencing hearing because of a series of failings in the trial court that resulted in an improper decision to transfer, a racially biased jury, an unjustifiable conviction, and an unconstitutional and disproportionate sentence. So I will be addressing transfer and sufficiency of the evidence, and Mr. Hartford will address the jury issue. As a 14-year-old boy at the time, Zevian was presumptively under the juvenile court's jurisdiction. For a 14-year-old child to proceed in adult court, the Juvenile Court Act requires an individualized, careful balancing of statutory factors to determine whether discretionary transfer to adult court is appropriate. These factors are there for a reason, to ensure that the law is calibrated to meaningfully acknowledge the unique attributes and needs of children, despite the seriousness of their offenses. A decision to transfer a child has grave consequences. It erases the child's youth and treats that child as an adult, imposing adult punishments and retribution. But here, the fix was in. Despite multiple mitigating factors that weighed against transfer to adult court, the juvenile court steamrolled past any positive facts of Zevian, perverting the mitigating evidence into aggravating factors and making unreasonable inferences that all but ensured that transfer was the ultimate outcome. Errors permeated the transfer hearing. A few of the factors are worth highlighting here. Regarding Zevian's mental health and educational history, the juvenile court abused its discretion by unreasonably misconstruing expert testimony from Dr. Joel Eckert, a clinical psychologist who determined that Zevian was borderline impaired in his IQ assessment.
Counsel, I need to ask you about that because I read the record very, very carefully, and I read the doctor's testimony very, very carefully. And when the judge asked him what his opinion was, he said, "My opinion is based on two interviews with him, his school records, and the interview with his mother. That is where I used to the same conclusion that his current test results are less adequate than they should have been. And it is my professional opinion that under optimal circumstances, he would be functioning, my best guess, my professional opinion, between 70 and 85. And then when asked again, Dr. Eckhoff said, "I really would like another opinion. I don't have a lot of confidence in my opinion." Go ahead.
That's correct, Your Honor. Position here is that it's not that the court sort of discounted discredited that the expert, which the courts can do. Our position here is that the court sort of took that testimony and misconstrued it in a way that was harmful to Zevian, because the court sort of interpreted it as this insidious sort of manipulative actions on part of Zevian to underrepresent his true abilities. And the expert was asked that question about, "Do you think that he intentionally skewed his results downward in any way?" And he said, "In my professional judgment, that, you know, while that's possible, that's certainly not what happened here." And he also noted that, as you said, under optimal circumstances, he would test higher, but he noted that he's, you know, incarcerated, there's some drug use. So he said that he was zoned out for part of, you know, and he was spaced out for part of this testimony, which again, doesn't reasonably lead to a conclusion that he was manipulating the results in a way to advantage himself, which is what the inference that the judge took from that.
But the doctor also said, and what the judge what the doctor also said, that his academic scores, his achievement test scores, and his performance in school were absolutely inconsistent with a person who scored what Xavion scored on the Wechsler test.
Correct. And that created the expert's sort of uncertainty about the results. However, he still testified that his professional judgment is that Xavion scored below average in his intelligence testing, even considering that he had average test scores. But again, that doesn't, the issue is not about the confusion around the test scores, but more about the courts taking that and interpreting that as sort of this manipulation of on the part of Xavion, which is that the record does not support that.
Can you cite to me in the record where the judge concluded that Xavion manipulated the test scores?
Yes. So on supplemental record 193, the judge says, Dr. Eckert did express a great deal of concern about the testing he administered to the minor because it was not consistent with his school records or the testing that the minor had received at school. And we do know that the minor has a history of being able to provide what I believe are misleading test or assessment results. And then he says similar things regarding the IQ, or excuse me, regarding the probation testimony as well, that probation officers testified that he, a record for that is supplemental record 198, where he says that Xavion had deceived two very experienced probation officers when the probation officers testified positively that he was compliant with supervision, was compliant with his programming. So when a transfer to criminal court occurs, the prosecution and trial of such a child must be handled with exceptional care in light of the elevated criminal exposure for a child defendant, particularly when one of the harshest criminal penalties, de facto life sentence, is at stake. But Xavion's prosecution and conviction proceeded without sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he personally discharged a firearm, and thus do not justify a 25-year discretionary firearm enhancement that more than doubles his adult sentence of 45 years. And so to secure that conviction of unlawful possession of a firearm and the 25 additional years, what is the evidence that the state used here? The state offered a single eyewitness testimony of TB that is logically inconsistent and uncorroborated. This case involves two individuals, one gun, one person in a dark hoodie, and one person in a white hoodie.
Your time is up. You'll have time in reply.
Okay.
This is happening. And I believe at this time, an associate of yours is coming on screen.
That is correct.
Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Hartford, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Hartford for the appellant, Xavion Marks. A jury with a racially biased juror convicted Xavion Marks at the trial court. That fact is unequivocal. Juror Short affirmatively stated that he thought Black people were more likely to commit crimes than white people. While we believe that the trial court's failure to remove Juror Short was a due process violation, I will focus on the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. We ask the court to vacate Xavion's conviction and grant him a new trial because trial counsel was ineffective for failing to move to strike Juror Short. Juror Short stated he thought African Americans are more likely to commit crimes than white people. Trial counsel did not ask to strike Juror Short from the panel. That failure to strike constitutes nothing short of clear ineffective assistance of counsel.
Given what was the dialogue, Mr. Hartford? Let's have a whole context here. What was the question put to the juror?
Yes, Your Honor. The juror was asked whether or not he thought Black people were more likely to commit crimes than white people. He responded, yes, it seems that way. He then blamed some news sources as to why he believed that. But nonetheless, he did affirmatively state that he thought Black people were more likely to commit crimes than white people.
What was the affirmative statement?
It was a response, Your Honor, to the question.
Give me the words.
The question itself was, do you believe that Black people are more likely to commit crimes than white people? He says specifically on page 77 of the record, what about African Americans? Do you think they're more likely to commit crimes than whites? And Mr. Short responded, yes, it seems that way. You know,
yes, it seems that way. Is that what he said?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then what else did he say, if anything?
He said, yeah, if you watch the news, yes. He finished with the affirmative yes.
You watch the news.
Yes, and it's true, Your Honor, it's not, he does blame a third party, but that in no way takes away from the explicit bias that he exhibits in that response.
What's an explicit bias, Mr. Hartford?
An explicit bias here is his opinion that before he even walks into a courtroom, that somebody who is African-American is partially the way they're having committed a crime just by the color of his skin.
Well, that's a conclusion. I want to know what the bias is.
Your Honor, this would be racial bias against Black people in considering them to be more likely than white people to commit crimes.
So his statement, it seems that way in the context from the media, is that what
he does really follow it? About? He does follow it up by saying that, you know, that he blames it on the media. And it's true that he does say that it's the media's fault. But nonetheless, he still believes it.
Does it say what? The media what?
Well, he says that he based his opinion on what he's seen in the media. And while that may be the case, it in no way takes away from the fact that he goes into that courtroom with the opinion, be it from the news media or from somewhere else, that Black people are more likely to commit crimes than white people. And on top of that, counsel for Xavion didn't object to that, whether or not.
What did he say thereafter? Were there any questions put to him thereafter by either the court or any counsel in the courtroom?
Counsel did speak with the juror about his handgun possession, what type of television he liked to watch, some other exchanges, but none of them made up for the fact that he stated in open court that he thought Black people were more likely to commit crimes than white people.
Didn't he indicate that he thought he could be fair and impartial and set that aside?
He did, Your Honor. And that may have been the case. We don't know. For purposes of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, this is just such a serious violation. The fact that he even exhibited this, whether or not he followed it up with some level of impartiality, should have triggered a response in Xavion's counsel's mind that he needed to move to strike that juror for cause. And there's really no additional assurances or statements that can be made to cure such a prejudicial opinion on behalf of Juror Short. And where there's no valid strategic reason for an action, in this case, the lack of action on behalf of trial counsel in moving to strike Juror Short, it fails that first prong of Strickland, which is to show that an unreasonable action was taken on behalf of the defendant. Strickland has a second prong of prejudice, and Supreme Court recognized in Weaver versus Massachusetts that that can be shown where a particular violation is so serious that it renders a trial fundamentally unfair. And Your Honors, there are few, if any, more serious violations that render a trial fundamentally unfair than a juror believing a defendant is predisposed to guilt because of the color of his skin. That is a structural error, and it undermines the constitutional guarantee of a fair criminal trial. We ask the court to vacate Xavion's conviction and grant him a new trial, a fair trial that his counsel should have called for in the first place. Thank you.
Questions from the court?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hartford. You and your co-counsel will have opportunity in reply. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Nicolosi, response?
Yes. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, counselors. The state submits that this court should affirm the defendant's transfer into adult court and his conviction and his sentence in this case. Starting with issue one, the transfer, the state believes the court did not abuse its discretion in deciding to transfer the defendant. As I state repeatedly in my brief, the case law has made clear that the two most important factors when considering whether to transfer a minor into adult court are the seriousness of the offense and the prior history of delinquency of the minor. And the state submits that the evidence in this case is very strong on both factors. Quite obviously, the crime committed here and the evidence that they had at the time was a very, very serious crime occurred. Defendant, in an attempt to rob Darius Fair, pulled a gun on him and shot him to his death. Fair's girlfriend was with him at the time, knew who defendant was through Facebook. Very confident in her identification. That all gave probable cause to arrest defendant and charge him. And again,
why are we talking about this? I thought your issue was on the transfer.
Well, that's the most serious factor in a transfer, Your Honor, and the seriousness of the offense and the defendant's prior record, of course. Those are, case law has established, those are the two most prominent factors to consider. Your Honors and counsel discussed Dr. Eckert and the evidence of his testing and his education and stuff. While that's all fine to consider, of course, it's not the most prominent factor that needs to be. And I think the record shows that the trial court considered all of the factors that he was required in this case. Talked about the defendant's age, talked about the defendant's turbulent upbringing. He considered all those things, all the mitigating factors, the fact that the defendant graduated from school, things of that nature. Considered mitigating factors, but again, the state submits the overwhelming aggravating factors in this case that really point to transfer. Again, let's talk about the prior history again. One of the two most important factors in this case, just about 6 months before the instant case, defendant was adjudicated delinquent for an armed robbery, another incredibly serious crime where he pulled a gun on another individual, put the gun in the person's mouth, broke his teeth, forced him to strip naked. This is two incredibly serious crimes in a 6 month passage of time. That considered with the instant crime and the other evidence, there's just nothing that can outweigh those two factors. In this case, the state submits the trial court properly analyzed everything, put all his considerations on the record, and the state submits that the court did not abuse its discretion in transferring.
Mr. Nicolosi, are there any cases that you can tell us about that discuss the impact of Miller and Buffer on the consideration of the seriousness of the offense?
Are we talking about the transfer, Your Honor, or are we talking about sentencing?
You're talking about the transfer.
Your Honor, I don't know if there are any cases offhand where you think that
there should be some consideration?
Your Honor, I think the law on transfers has been established that these are the items that the court is to consider. I wouldn't know what else a court could consider, not considering the seriousness of the crime and the history and the behavior and the emotional and things of the defendant. I don't know what else a court would be to consider except for these factors.
At the time, when was it established that the seriousness of the crime is the primary factor?
I don't have this site is certainly in my brief, Your Honor. I can look it up if you'd like me to do that. But
well, for purposes of my question, I'd like for you to tell me. Yeah.
Well, actually, then I'm going to correct myself. It's actually in the statute itself that the more weight should be given to the seriousness of the alleged offense and the minor's prior record of delinquency, other factors listed in the sub. So okay, I guess it goes even earlier than I originally thought. It's actually in the statute itself.
Okay, so in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Miller, and they said that when you're dealing with juveniles, there's some other considerations that come into play. Have there been any cases to your knowledge that have talked about the impact of Miller on the decision with regard to juvenile transfer to adult court relative to the seriousness of the offense?
Not that I'm aware of. I certainly didn't look that up. So they could be there, they could not be. But again, I was under the impression Miller and Buffer and all those cases dealt primarily with sentencing after a conviction in adult court. I would be surprised if there were cases that kind of reflected on that in transfer. Again, these factors rely upon the judge to consider the defendant's age and his maturity level and all of these things in determining whether to transfer. So I think it's kind of just ingrained in the factors themselves that the judge supposed to consider who in fact is on the line here to be treated. I think it goes without saying, honestly. Moving on to issue number two regarding not removing the juror, the state submits that number one, that this record is incomplete for even discussing what trial counsel was thinking when it came to Juror Short. We have no idea why counsel did not remove Juror Short. I think, of course, a collateral proceeding where we'd actually hear from counsel would be a more appropriate forum for this discussion. But if we are considering this issue, the state submits that counsel is not ineffective. State submits that as Justice Holdridge was alluding to and discussing with counsel, out the conversation between counsel and juror Short. Juror Short did not in any way indicate that he was racist or that he had anything against this defendant. He had simply affirmatively stated that he believed white people or people were more likely to commit crimes, and he based that on what he saw in the news.
Actually, he said black people were more likely to commit crimes.
Oh, did I misspeak? I apologize.
Yeah.
Again, he, as Justice Albrecht alluded to, Juror Short indicated he could be fair and impartial when counsel followed up with him. The state submits this is different than Juror Montz, who basically confirmed the same belief that black people were more likely to commit crimes than white people. But the difference was that Montz had indicated that he read information on this case in the media. That's why that justified his removal from the case. That type of reveal was not made by Short. He hadn't watched anything, heard anything, so he could have been impartial. But based on the record that we have, The state submits the counsel's performance was not deficient. If this court finds it was, the state submits and it was not prejudiced by counsel's representation. And that kind of leads right into issue three, talking about the strength of the evidence against the defendant. The state submits that the evidence is very strong and that the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the murder of Zarius Fair. Again, TB is a very, very strong witness in this case. She was with Zarius Fair when the defendant had approached her. She knew the defendant. She knew him from Facebook. And after a defendant shot Zarius Fair, TB called the police. They came. She immediately directed police towards the defendant's Facebook profile. Later, she immediately identified the defendant in the photo lineup. She identified the defendant in court. She knew who he was. She saw him at a Kroger at some point once before. She also knew the other individual, Mr. Nelson, that was with the defendant at the time of the murder. She had seen him in school. So she knew who these people were. Her identification all along the way was rock solid.
Well, there was an inconsistency, wasn't there, in regard to the color of the sweatshirt or something?
Yes, Your Honor, regarding the color of the sweatshirt. But again, that the state submits that inconsistency does not override the confident identifications that she's made the whole way. And regarding the sweatshirt, even the defendant's mother identified him in a video as the man in the video wearing the white shirt. He had one arm in the shirt, one arm out of the shirt. Again, the state would submit that would, of course, lead to the logical conclusion the defendant was holding a firearm with the other arm in the shirt. I think that goes a long way to corroborating TB's testimony and identifications in the case. The state submits that because of the strength of the evidence against the defendant, that leads right into the fact that there was not prejudice against the defendant if this court were to find that trial counsel provided deficient performance in that. So with that, the state submits again that this court should find that the transfer is appropriate and that the defendant's conviction and sentence be affirmed. Are there any other questions? I'd be happy to answer.
Questions from the court?
No.
Okay. Ms. Sefa, you are splitting your time in reply?
No, Your Honor, I'm replying.
Okay.
Yeah.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Wanted to address the question that Justice McDade had asked about transfer and about the factors of the seriousness of the offense and the prior adjudication. While we recognize, as counsel said, that the transfer statute itself affords greater weight to the seriousness of the alleged offense and the prior record of the minor, these factors are not dispositive and do not create a presumption that a child should be transferred. In fact, juvenile court is an appropriate venue for even serious cases such as this one. The law contemplates a careful balancing of the five factors, not a two-factor test that preordains transfer. And for certain categories of cases and children in Illinois, that is actually the case, that the law allows for presumptive and even automatic transfers to adult court for certain kids. But Xavion's case is neither. Thus, the seriousness of the current offense and one prior adjudication, even if violent as it is, does not presuppose a transfer decision. And there must be sufficient evidence and consideration in the record as to each statutory factor to support the transfer order. So the evidence on the factors of Xavion's history of domestic of abuse or neglect, his mental health and education history, and his willingness to participate in services are all weighed in favor of resolving his case in the juvenile system. And so the court's rejection of much of that positive evidence that would have opposed transfer sort of demonstrates that there's no way he could have overcome the seriousness of the offense or the one.
What evidence is there in the record they rejected that? Rejection means something different. I mean, you got to be careful of our words here. Are you saying the court didn't acknowledge consideration of those? or they're supposed to weigh them, you know, not reject.
Right. And so, for example, in the situation of the abuse and neglect factor, which I hadn't addressed earlier, that factor, the court says, I find there's no evidence of abuse or neglect. And in fact, that determination was contrary to the evidence. The record does show, indisputably show, that there were allegations of choking and pushing of Xavion's mom, orders of protection between Xavion's mom and Xavion's stepfather. His stepfather was actually convicted of domestic battery against his mother. So even though Xavion was not the direct target of that abuse, the court's refusal to acknowledge that mitigating factor for Xavion is an abuse of discretion. Case law is clear that.
Counsel, I didn't read the record that way. What I read the record to say, what I heard, when I read the judge's rendition of his decision, he said there was no direct abuse, evidence of direct abuse of Xavion, but he did witness domestic violence between his parents, and he said his mother moved away. Now, you're in. Interpretation and my interpretation of the evidence may be different than that, and we may take it more seriously than that, but I did not see, and I read it very carefully for this, I did not see that the judge misreported the evidence.
The judge, I think it's clear from the record, did not acknowledge that evidence as mitigating, and that evidence, the case law is clear that that even if you are not the direct target of domestic violence, living in a household that's disruptive, that's violent, that's chaotic, is mitigating for the purposes of the transfer statute itself. And we cite that in our brief. And so the fact that the court takes this very narrow interpretation of what is actually abuse and neglect and excludes the undisputed evidence of neglect in violation of case law and of the transfer statute itself is an abuse of discretion on that factor.
Your reading of the record is different than mine then.
Are there any other questions?
Have you concluded?
Yes. So
you have more time. Oops. The light has gone off. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. And we respectfully ask that this court vacate its convictions and remand for a new trial, or alternatively vacate his sentence and remand for new sentencing hearing. Thank you for your time.
Any questions from the court?
No.
No? No. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, counsel, both for your arguments in this matter. It will be taken under advisement. A written disposition will issue. The clerk of our court will escort you out of our remote courtroom at this time.